Welcome to the University of Washington's Political Economy Forum. We bring together diverse scholars, policymakers, and citizens to discuss current public policy issues, to inform the public about them, and to find evidence-based solutions. Feel free to visit our website at uwpoliticaleconomy.com. We publish new episodes of this podcast every week. If you have questions or suggestions for discussion topics, please contact us on Twitter at ForumUW or email us at uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Hello, my name is Nicholas Wittstock and I'm a fellow at the Forum. Today I'm excited to speak to Carlos Bosch. Carlos is a renowned scholar of democracy and economic development. He's the Robert Garrett Professor of Politics and Public Affairs in the Department of Politics and the School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton.
Hello, Carlos Bosch.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Very happy to have you on. You are the author of Democratic Capitalism at the Crossroads, a book that asks a provocative question, I suppose, which is capitalism still compatible with democracy? What made you ask this question?
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure being here. So I think that basically I decided to write this book, basically for two reasons. One is that I have always been interested since, I guess, the time I was a PhD student many, many decades ago. I have always been interested in this question between democracy and capitalism, to what extent they are compatible. And really, when you look at the history of these two concepts, you see that the response has varied over time. So in the 19th century, everyone, both on the left and the right, thought that they were incompatible. So you read Marx clearly, could not be that the bourgeoisie would let it go and the power, but also conservatives and liberals were worried about full democracy and the extent to which it could basically kill markets. And so then you go into the 20th century and you find that progressively, at least after World War II, this growing consensus about the possibility of both being compatible. And some people coined the term democratic capitalism, by which they mean, it's possible to have representative democracy, markets, even though regulated, and pretty big welfare state. And then in the 21st century now, there is this questioning of the possibility of having the two of them. And so that's the first motivation. It's an intellectual motivation. I've always wanted to explore that. And then the second one is more related to our current moment, which is basically, I would say, age of anxiety about rising inequality, about populism, and the possible responses to technological changes that are affecting all of us. And, this anxiety about the future of employment, and so on. So these two things were the ones that motivate the book.
In the book, you argue that 20th century capitalism ultimately was so successful that this expectation, as you now describe it, that democracy and capitalism were compatible, became almost like an orthodoxy of sorts, that it became obvious that the two were compatible or something like that. But you also argue that it really resulted from a very particular configuration of production technologies and related economic institutions that made this marriage possible. So what that means then, right, is that there is a danger that those things come undone in some way, right? And that's, I think, where you argue the pressure point of dramatic technological change comes in, because it can fundamentally reshape the production structures of an economy, which I think is a little bit different from a lot of other arguments that are worried about technology, right? Because it's usually the argument goes, it drives polarization on social media or something like this, or it gives the state too much power to surveil its citizens or something like that. Whereas you really argue, no, it's about it fundamentally reshaping the economic structures of democracies as they exist right now. So what are some examples of this that make you worried about the future?
You're right. I mean, my argument, if you will, is different from most of the consensus or a lot of the things I read or things people tell me. And I normally have trouble with my, especially undergrad students, because they really want, so I have been, so let me say that this book is also grows out of teaching a seminar on democracy and capitalism for a few years with a, you know, in a seminar-like format. And most of students are very interested and tend to gravitate towards an explanation that emphasizes social media mm-hmm. as the culprit of everything. I don't know if that's because they are all the time on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok. I don't know exactly what it is. And I have some trouble convincing them that there may be other explanations. So having said that, yes, the book is, I think, different, although I have seen others also writing in this direction. It's different in the sense that to try to explain the sort of intellectual problem I was talking about at the beginning, the compatibility or the very incompatibility of democracy and capitalism over time, plus the anxiety of today, I turn towards technology. And my point of departure is, well, technological change has happened. It's in a way unavoidable. There is this search for profit and for productivity that is inherent to entrepreneurship or, you know, markets. I don't know exactly what it is, this force for profit, Schumpeterian, let's say, force, that leads to inventions that normally result in a process of capital labor substitution. So trying to save labor, new methods of production are invented. And these technologies, this technological change reshapes the relationship between labor and capital, if you will. So that if you look at the last 200 years, one way of thinking about it is that in the 19th century, with the first industrial revolution and the kinds of technologies that were used, the labor that was complementary, also needed in production, was mostly unskilled workers. Those are the guys that were hired. I mean, and also, you know, guys and also children, women, in fact, in textile factories. In the 19th century, they replaced artisans as the main type of labor employed in some kind of manufacturing. And that then led to this change as a result of a set of inventions that happened in the 20th century that lead to, you know, assembly line, electricity, and other things such as the steam engine. This changed the kind of labor that is used. Semi-skilled labor is the fundamental kind of force that is employed in industry. And then today, what we see is that this process of technological substitution, the search for automation and labor-saving technologies, has led to skilled labor, I guess, us being, or people like us, I guess, being that the ones that, I see you nodding your head, but we should be the optimistic, benefiting from these technologies, right? And so in a way, well, I'm not worried. I'm just trying to paint, if you will, in a canvas and with probably broader strokes, these changes. And I try to avoid in the book this temptation that many people have of telling the reader how the future is going to look like. Mm. So there are lots of books that sell because they paint the future as really dark or as really bright. And I don't want to do that. So I, you know, what I want is to explain what I see, perhaps, you know, wrongly, and then speculate through a set of assumptions about what may happen. In that sense, I'm not pessimistic. I'm concerned about things that change. But I think that, you know, instead of saying, oh, this is like the 19th century, which is something that some people say, you know, some say, oh, you know, there's lots of inequality. We are going back to Manchester and capitalism is doom. And I think that there are things that are very different. We have democratic institutions, at least in part of the world. And second, we are much richer than we were in 200 years ago. So we probably have a kind of flexibility in terms of responses that they didn't 200 years ago. So I'm concerned, but the book is not a technologically deterministic book.
That was definitely the idea that I was getting from the book, that certain pressures are exerted by technological change, but ultimately it all depends on the social and political institutions that you create as a society, in a politics, to mm-hmm. ultimately try to determine what the outcomes of those pressures are. As you did just now, right, in the book, you differentiate between these rough three different stages of capitalism, between Manchester, Detroit, and Silicon Valley, which are also sometimes referred to as sort of the first, second, and third industrial revolutions. You do point out that Manchester capitalism, the capitalism of the first industrial revolution, was fundamentally incompatible with full democratic institutions. Could you explain for our listeners real quick, why was that so? And what changed then over time?
Yeah, so absolutely. In the book, what I do is that I distinguish between three main moments, if you will. I call them Manchester, Detroit, and Silicon Valley, because I think that they were the place where these technologies I was talking about were born and first applied, right? So Manchester symbolizes captures the moment of the first industrial revolution. There is a process of mechanization. So the first machines are introduced in factories, which is a fundamentally new thing. So the old system was basically the old system of manufacturing was having mostly high skilled artisans, or not so skilled, but dispersed in different villages in a put out system, producing small quantities of things, pretty expensive. And so someone invents or mechanizes certain parts of the production process. These are put together in factories. And the idea is that the machine progressively so there is a process of division of labor. And the idea is to have machines that reproduce, at least in part, some of the things that workers do, and complementary managing working together with a machine, if you will. There are these very unskilled workers, uneducated. Basically, it's all time, very, very little education, and so on and so forth. They are paid low wages. They are, as I said, many times children and women are used, paid very little in very hard conditions. Living conditions are sometimes brutal. We have Engels writing a book on the conditions of workers in England, but not just Engels. Even the English Parliament issued or had reports done on the conditions of workers. At the same time, there is a growth of profits, so it leads to clearly an equal distribution. Inequality was high at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in terms of, there was a big peasant class and some kind of aristocracy, and then small cities. But then there is this inequality that grows or that rises in cities on top of the old regime inequality. So say in this context, democracy, which basically means the rule of the majority, is seen by both the old classes, the aristocratic classes, but also the new bourgeoisie, the new rising urban classes, as threatening mm-hmm. to property and so on. So that's why I discuss this very quickly. There is this clash between principle of democracy and capitalism, right? Between the idea of one person, one vote, and the idea of paying the marginal product to labor or to capital in conditions where capital is getting most of the production, right? Or the mm-hmm. So that's basically why Manchester is a place. But that's where when liberals and conservatives and Marx, the people I mentioned before, look at, they look at that period, and the evidence they get is, you know, if this is what the future is going to be, impossible to have capitalism and democracy. Something right. very different has to, or maintain the system without democracy, or social revolution and communism or socialism for those that want to change things.
What happened then in the Detroit phase of capitalism? What changed from this? What was it that Marx missed, if you will?
Well, I think that what we see is that by the end of the 19th century, there are these kinds of new technologies that transform how things are made. Electricity is invented. The steam engine becomes fundamental in transportation, but also in production. And I think that's why I use the term of Detroit, or the idea of Detroit, is that the assembly line is also invented, right? So Ford decides at one point at the beginning of the 20th century to make a car that will be cheap and safe, and charges his engineers with the search for something. And it's a really fascinating story, you know, for a year and a half, they experiment with different things, and progressively they find out that the best way to minimize costs is by developing the production of a car in the form of an assembly. So before that, all cars were built as if they were in an artisan shop. So there would be a team of workers, each one in charge of one part of the car. The car would be basically in one place, and they would assemble the car. And now they move all these things. Kind of, I think that one of the fundamental points, or the ways in which they imagine this, is by seeing that in Chicago in the 1860s, to process all the meat, all the cows that came from the West, and Chicago was the place through which they went, you know, they moved everything to sell in the Eastern markets, in Europe, and so on. They invented this assembly line. So they would hang the all these animals, and then they would move them, and they would, you know, cut them and take their hide and all these kinds of things. So Ford just reverses the concept, says instead of disassembling, let's assemble.
Right.
And this is helped by electricity. Electricity gives a flexibility in the way you can set up things that was not possible before. And so these, in fact, you know, Detroit is not the only place. There are other places that have something called the batch production machine. That's basically tobacco, for example. They invented these machines where they would feed this machine with tobacco and paper, and the machine would spit cigarettes at a very fast pace already in the 1880s. And the prices in the production of cigarettes dropped very quickly. So it's all, you know, it's at the time, you know, it's all inventions. There are many people competing to get some kind of solution to the problem. The thing about this is that then, and also because in transportation, as I said, electricity becomes more and more used, and then gas, the old labor, the very unskilled labor, becomes less relevant to production. Firms need people that know how to read and to write and to communicate and to kind of understand machines, from driving something to you know, repairing something. And so there is this growth of what we say, you know, we call this a semi-skilled labor, labor that in the US would have an education up till high school or almost high school, right? There is demand for these types of workers, and a lot of people go to school. They get wages at that time grow. I mean, there's a big productivity jump because of all these innovations. Wages go together with this. The wages of all these sort of what in the US is called middle class, but in Europe normally people refer to as working class. Mm-hmm. So we can see that because of all these kind of middle strata benefit from these changes, there is a process of equalization of in the distribution of income. So technology is this technological change is a fundamental part of this process. There may have been other things. I mean, there is a debate in the literature about what led to this equalization of wages and income in Europe in advanced economies. But I think that at the bottom of it, there were these technologies that enabled firms to hire people that were more productive and could be paid better.
It also, in the book, you argue that it also, this case has been made by a variety of authors, right? That this also raised the willingness to make co-specific investments on the part of business, right? In the form of, accepting higher taxation, which would then be used for things like welfare investments, which would reduce the risks of engaging in different commercial activities on the part of workers, for example, smooth against income risk, against job loss, or things like that. But also to increase investment in education, because as you said, right, it was now no longer the case that unskilled labor was the main complement to the most innovative parts of capital, but rather it was now semi-skilled labor, right? So you needed some investment in education, and that was in the interest of capital ultimately. But what does this have to do with democracy? How did this impact democratic institutions in any way? What was the impact here?
Well, So absolutely, I agree with what you said. I do not want to minimize. So I said, technology changes things through the arrangement of systems of production and all the kinds of, things that firms need and type of labor they want to hire and so on. I don't want to minimize the role of politics here. Mm-hmm. So at the same time these things happen, there is pressure from society, workers, middle classes, different actors, and to have this process of sharing in a growth of sharing this growing economy. And at the same time, as you said, firms in a way they have an incentive. They are okay to have the state or some institutions that coordinate the supply of certain types of public goods, right? So they have an interest in having relatively educated workers, healthy workers, and a society that is well organized and where investment is takes place in a stable institutional system and so on. How does democracy come here? Well, I think that in part democracy is part of these public goods, but for some authors, for me, it's mostly that because of growth and because of growing equality of conditions, then democracy as a solution becomes less contentious because the costs of so democracy basically is a system where the majority votes, where this majority can impose solutions, establish taxes, regulating systems that may, if you will, hurt or jeopardize at least the profits of capital and the functioning of the operation of the market. To the extent that there is more to share, to the extent that this economy grows in such a way that if I see that I moderate my demands, growth will continue and I will be better off. To the extent that there are certain kinds of things, such as the public goods we talked about, where people can coordinate and they see that this is in itself good in terms of enhancing the life, the standards of, the living standards of everyone, but also the, making the economy more prosperous and so on. All these things reduce this level of contention or this kind of risk that with which democracy was associated in the 19th century. Everybody has a stake. That's where, these two things kind of come together, especially by the second half of the 20th century.
You show in the book that politics was tempered significantly. Right? So from, very, very polarized ideological extremes in a lot of places, politics really moves in the middle and it becomes more about technical expertise at managing, you know, different economic conflicts or political conflicts. It's not so much about fundamental systematic critique or anything like that. But what changes then under Silicon Valley capitalism in the 1970s?
Before I answer this question, let me say, you know, I mean, there may be other explanations, and I try to explore them in the book, right? So there, in, what I do I mean is that, say, the success of democracy in Europe in the 1950s and 60s and 70s compared to the big crisis that took place in the 1920s and 1930s and that they ended up with World War II. To me, at the end of the day, this transformation of the economy was fundamental. So two things. One is, this is not incompatible with other explanations, but I know that others would question my thesis, right? They would say, oh, the, you know, democracy succeeded in Europe because the Americans came in and they pacified the continent. And or there was a communist threat, and then there's this threat, the establishment, elites, capitalists, whatever, they, whatever term you want to use, had an incentive to strike a deal, with labor and socialist parties and so on and so forth. And I think there is something to this, but I think that this would not have been sustainable without all these transformations that took place. Because we have removed the US from Europe, basically. The Soviet Union has collapsed. And still, you know, for those places that still have the good economic conditions, democracy is still in place and alive and, you know, kicking and alive and alive and kicking. So anyway, let me go to Silicon Valley. So, you know, again, you know, I start with some sort of exploration of the changes that took place, the invention of the microchip, of computers, of a set of technologies that now are everywhere in the internet and all kinds of tools that we now take for granted, but that really didn't exist in the before 1980 or before 1990 or even before 2000, right? All these things have made possible the progressive automation of many more routine jobs. So here I really borrow from wonderful work by an economist, David Autor, who distinguishes between, you know, he sort of emphasizes this idea that we can think of jobs as some being very routinary or routine jobs and others that are not, are more creative. For the first type of jobs, basically this means that we can develop rules, or we can understand these jobs as the implementation of rules that then can be automatized. We can write algorithms in our computers that reproduce these very routine things. And of course, this has led progressively to a shift also in employment again. So basically, what we see, for example, is that in the last decades, there has been a growth in absolute terms of the class of professionals and managers and people that are, if you will, creative or at least engaged in the management of people, which is the part that is more difficult. You know, it's difficult to routinize or to describe as a set of very exact procedures that then can be transferred into or converted into an algorithm. Whereas things such as clerical tasks and very tedious administrative tasks, they have been computerized in some way. So there has been a decline in these type of jobs. This has led to a transformation of the job market in the sense that the routine jobs, so both manual and non-manual, which I think this is one of the fundamental changes. We were used to manual jobs in a way disappearing because of mechanization already in the 60s and the 70s. But now this is affecting also non-manual, you know, white-collar jobs. And this has been a shock to the system. This has happened at the same time. The new technologies seem to be better or benefit engineers or architects or researchers or managers. And when we look at the data, especially in the US, the returns to education have changed. Salaries of individuals who have not completed high school, so they are high school dropouts, in the US have not changed in real terms since the 1960s. Whereas the income of people with university degrees, especially post grad or post undergrad degrees, have multiplied in real terms by two or three times larger today. So there has been this growing divergence in income according to education, which seems to be related to this technological change and the demand for in the market for different types of things, for different types of individuals and skills, right? So that's one fundamental thing that has changed. Stretch a bit the argument, and here some people have complained to me, especially economists, in the following sense. I think that these technologies have also been important in explaining globalization. A lot of people explain globalization as the result of a political choice. And it may be true, I mean, maybe the case that at one point, a lot of countries decided to globalize. But I think that the globalization of today, what I call in the book Globalization 2.0, mm-hmm. is also the result of technological change. In part, it's the result of transportation costs declining, but also communication costs becoming much lower. This has made possible for many multinationals or corporations to split their production. So they maintain headquarters and certain kinds of activities in their countries of origin, but they have moved production
right.
to other places in the world in a way that I think would not have been possible in the past. And it is in a way related to these technologies and has also created a lot of anxiety among workers and middle class individuals in Europe, in the US, because they feel threatened by this, the offshoring of production.
Yeah, absolutely. You said, right, that there are earlier that there are several accounts that describe the future as either very positive or very negative in a sort of deterministic way. So one fear, right, related to automation would be that either we're going to be in a situation where there's only going to be a couple of extremely well-educated, highly talented, creative workers that make very, very, very high salaries. And, you know, again, you know, Marx strikes back with being vindicated and there being sort of an immiserated working class that has no skills effectively. And is competing for the few low-skill jobs that are left. And that would then return to a politics where the owners of capital are extremely anxious about extending the franchise in any real way to the masses, right? And the masses being incentivized to effectively vote for complete redistribution or something like this. So this would create this like repolarization, if you will, of politics. Is that a realistic danger of the future? Because I must say I'm not so convinced of that really becoming a reality. I mean, it doesn't matter if I am or not, but just for the sake of conversation.
No. I think this is a fundamental point. And again, you know, in the book, after going through these three stages or phases we talked about, I spent one chapter on this question of the future. And as I think I said at the beginning, I wanted to escape from being either a techno-optimist or a techno-pessimist. Mm-hmm. In part, I think it's just character. I'm uncomfortable with, you know, making these big, asserting these things. And also, I think it's also professional training that I, you know, I want to give a, you know, their due part to everyone. What I do in the chapter is I say, you know, what the future is going to look like is going to depend on a set of things, right? And the fact that techno-optimists and techno-pessimists are so much at odds with each other depends on where they fall in terms of what kinds of assumptions they make. So what I try to say is, well, it's going to depend on what is the kind of labor demand that we are going to have. What is the kind of supply of labor we're going to have? how is there these technologies going to affect capital, and what about the institutions and how they are going to respond, or we are going to respond to these changes? And so in terms of demand of labor, this is where a lot of the debate is, to what extent these technologies are going to change so quickly that they will automatize everything. And here we have a lot of disagreement. But the strange thing is that even those that say that things are going to change, they never date the moment things will change. And so this also makes me cautious about, I think that things are changing. And we have seen this. Now, whether there is going to be this moment of, you know, this breaking moment, this rupture, which is called AI, basically, we are not sure. But I think that even if it happened, it's always to be conditional on labor supply. So the extent to which people will be able to adjust to these new technologies, if for some reason everybody becomes very, you know, gets a master in something in politics and, you know, becomes proficient at dealing with machines of the new type, of course, then we are all saved. If not, then we may be in trouble, because there will be a part of the population that, if indeed this change happens, will not be able to adapt. And so then here, you know, we have all this debate about universal income and so on and so forth. But then what I also try to look at is at capital. You know, what are the effects of technology? Some are very Marxist. Capital will become very concentrated. It may be, but also we have evidence that these technologies sometimes lead to help small producers. And I, in the book, I give an example taken from someone else, which is basically the positive impact of cells on agricultural producers in Africa. They have really benefited from mechanisms that give them information about prices, that allow them to coordinate with buyers, all kinds of things that, you know, basically tell us that these technologies can be very good. They also can be very good in the sense of, you know, helping the people to become less poor. And the last thing is about institutions, how resilient they're going to be. I just want to just sell the book in one thing that I think people do not talk too much about. And I know that the book is mostly about advanced countries, but at the end of the book, I spent a few pages on less developed countries. And I really think this is an area we should be talking about much more, because if indeed these technologies advanced enough, till now they have led to offshoring.
Right.
But it may be a point where they will lead to onshoring, you know, to many things back, because if you say that your production plant is completely automatized, you don't need any labor. Why should, and your all your consumers here are all in Frankfurt or London or Barcelona or Seattle. There is no point in moving things through the Suez Canal. You know, it's always, now we know it's pretty risky and costly. So you move things back. So this means that countries that have bet on manufacturing as a way of developing will not have this path to modernity. I think, to me, this is really one of the most interesting, this one thing. And the other thing is, how is this, which takes us back to the advanced countries, how is this change in labor markets going to affect the integration of migrants or immigrants into our societies, right? Because normally the Detroit model was one in which, because of the opportunities it afforded to people that were not very skilled, but they could get some education, they became part of an affluent working class. But what if the labor market becomes very polarized? You have very skilled people, and then you have others that are not as skilled. This is going to make it difficult for immigrants to move through the, you know, up in the in the social ladder. And that's something also that I think people should be talking more about.
Absolutely. I think your point about the impact of automation on developing countries and especially their chances of developing democratic institutions is very much underappreciated in the literature. Absolutely. Because it also relates to some of your earlier work on, as you pointed out in the beginning, the connection between economic development and democratization, right? So if you take away the opportunity, or at least one opportunity to become more wealthy, it might also become more complicated to develop democratic institutions, which then may put a little bit of a twist on this question of like, how does Silicon Valley impact democracy? It might not necessarily do that in the developed West, but it might have substantial impact across the world. Let me ask a slightly different question. Aren't several features of the capitalist democracies that we've been talking about so far already exhibiting a form of sort of undemocratic liberalism? Haven't there already been several moves towards institutions that seem to suggest that markets are demanding a kind of politics that cannot really be all that responsive to mass opinion?
Wow, this is a big question. Well, I cannot, you know, I'm not going to fall into the trap of thinking that my book explains everything. You know, it's like, oh, I found the lever or the cause of everything. In the book, I try to think about how technology is changing things and is related to certain kinds of dilemmas and tensions that we observe. Having said that, I'm going to use this moment to say that many times a lot of people have reacted or thought about, defined or reasoned about populist movements as terrible things that, endanger democracy. And it may well be the case. I'm not denying that this could be the case. On the other thing, I think that democracy has a value, especially for those societies that are pretty stable. They have a democratic culture, they're rich, and so on, that allows for what I would call rebalancing or break equilibration, so that if there are crises, people have mechanisms to protest and to have their voice heard, even though sometimes the voice is terrible and it sort of hurts your ear, the ways in which things are said. And so in a sense, I think that, these populist movements are dangerous in some senses, but on the other hand, they are a part of the change of the, they are a signal that things have to, that there have been things that have not worked well for some people, and they should be taken care of. And so in that sense, democracy or democratic elections are an interesting way of dealing with this problem. I'm sort of optimistic because we are so rich, right? Compared to the two, and I'm talking about the advanced countries, right? So, and compared to where we were like 100 years or even 50 years ago, in spite of all the tensions, there seem to be ways to move forward.
Right. So what would be some of these ways to move forward? You mentioned some of the policies like universal basic income or something like this. Can you leave us with any sort of concrete policy suggestions that you think would ameliorate the situation?
Well, I think that to me, as I said, these different interventions depend on... So I'm not in favor of all the interventions I list. But rather, I suggest the reader to think, what are the things that you think or we think that are going to happen? And depending on that, then the degree of intervention maybe, has to be more radical or less. I think that the fundamental one, which I think most people agree, is education and making sure that people have access to mechanisms that allow them to develop completely and to be productive and free. That's a fundamental one. It could be that we have to introduce some systems of support, of income support. But one of the things that I try to insist is on democratic institutions. There should be mechanisms to make sure that money doesn't take control over elections. And I suggest several possibilities to democratize it in a way. For example, the way in which elections are financed. I'm very much in favor of some kind of decentralized rule in the sense that to try to make representatives slightly closer to their constituents. In that sense, I think that the small countries in Europe are at an advantage because they're very transparent. They have representatives that represent very few people. They have had a long tradition of dealing with globalization and understanding the benefits of it while trying to manage it. So those are a few of the things that I suggest. Now, I don't think I have any clear solutions. If I did, I would be immensely rich because I would be selling them somewhere.
Well, Carlos Bosch, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
No, it was great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Political Economy Forum podcast. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You might also like our special podcast on election security, Neither Free Nor Fair, which is hosted by Professor James Long and is also available on all major platforms. Our podcasts are produced by Morgan Wack and myself, Nicholas Wittstock. Our theme music was created by Ted Long. Please feel free to leave a review as we're curious about your feedback. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please contact UW Political Economy at gmail.com.